searching for life in the clouds of Venus and creating a space for birds. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Within the clouds of Venus, researchers are finding gases that are often linked to biological cycles here on Earth. So could the hottest planet in our solar system harbor life? And how can we even search for life on Venus? We'll speak with Cardiff University's Jane Greaves about those questions and her team's proposal to search for these gases and potentially answer the age-old question, could life exist on other planets? Then, need a book recommendation this summer? How about one that compares space travel and aviation to birds? Veteran Canadian astronaut Roberta Bonder brings her knowledge as an astronaut back down to Earth in her book, Space for Birds, Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. We'll speak with Bonder about her book and how birds can help humans, plus how we should help them. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? It's the age-old question. Are we alone in the universe? And it's propelled researchers to search for life on other worlds, from exoplanets to Jupiter's moon Europa, and even Venus. Venus is the hottest planet in our solar system, making any lander mission to the planet nearly impossible. But one team is proposing a spacecraft mission that searches Venus's skies, specifically its clouds. Cardiff University professor Jane Greaves and her team have identified gases like phosphine for years within Venus's clouds. Our producer Marion Summerall spoke with Greaves about her hope to help send a probe to search for life on Venus. Here's that conversation now.
Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be here.
I'm really glad you're here to talk about one of Earth's neighbors, Venus. I really want to talk about some of the proposals that your team has been making because it looks like we're finding some signs of life on Venus. But before we get into what your team is proposing and how you plan to do this, I want to take us back to where this all started. Why are you so fascinated with Venus and where could life exist?
Well, I'm intrigued by the idea that's been around since about the 1960s, that maybe Venus used to be a nicer, more temperate planet like the Earth with, you know, oceans and stuff. And then there was a terrible runaway greenhouse catastrophe, and the surface got much too hot for anything living. But the intriguing idea is that tiny microorganisms, you know, like little algae kind of scale things, could exist in the clouds of Venus if they have some way of floating. If they're just small enough, they can just like ride the waves of air. And I was also intrigued. This sounds amazing, but it's not really been searched for. So we got into the game as a kind of team of people interested almost in extrasolar planets more than the solar system. And the drive there is really to look for gases in planetary atmospheres that can really only come from living things. So that's how we started, yeah.
At the Royal Astronomical Society's National Astronomy Meeting, that's a long, long word.
Yeah.
That's a long title. You and your team proposed a plan to go to Venus or to send a spacecraft to Venus to look at some gases that are kind of unexplainable right now. Tell me what gases we're talking about here and what this proposal is.
Yeah, so the gases are things that we know life on Earth does make, particularly in conditions where there isn't oxygen to use. So two of these gases are phosphine and ammonia, which are kind of chemically similar. So phosphine is a phosphorus atom with three hydrogens attached, and ammonia is a nitrogen atom with three hydrogens attached. And we're probably more familiar with that one in like household chemicals and so on. But the place they have in the search for life is they're made by some kinds of microorganisms, but they've not really been searched for on other planets because they'd be present in tiny amounts, like one part in a million molecules kind of thing. So we have been trying to do this with, particularly with radio telescopes on the Earth, but it's really difficult, even though Venus is like our nearest neighbor planet. And so an opportunity came up to put in, it's just a proposal at this stage, to send a small spacecraft that could do this to orbit Venus. And so it'd have a much better view. It could maybe hang around in that orbit for a couple of years and look for these gases really intensively rather than us like begging another telescope on Earth if we can have another night or something like that. So yeah, we're really excited for this this novel idea.
That is really exciting, especially because there hasn't really been a fly by Venus in a really long time. And you're basically proposing like, hey, we need to bring some of this research back.
Yeah, because obviously in orbit around Venus, you could get so much more detail. you know, if you see, I don't know, a storm system or something, the spacecraft could track it. You know, you wouldn't miss all the good action. So that's the idea.
And where are we finding some of these gases, these things like ammonia and phosphine? Where would the probe kind of be going to find them?
So the probe would be looking downwards, basically, at the tops of the clouds. The clouds of Venus are very thick and they're kind of very hard to see through at almost any wavelength of light, radio or optical, infrared, whatever you used. But the wavelengths we're proposing to use, which are kind of about half a millimeter, small fraction of an inch kind of wavelengths, they can see the tops of the clouds really well. So what we think is that the molecules that might be made by whatever sources, so there might be something on the surface, if it's like a geological thing, or there might be something in the clouds, still really high up, like 50 kilometers. We think those trace molecules, these parts per million molecules, will still drift upwards because that's the way the atmosphere works. And so even if we can only look at the top of the clouds, we'll see these molecules kind of pop up. And where we see them pop up, we can relate that to where the sources are. So if it was something to do with like a giant volcano on the surface, we'd see it somewhere near that in the skies above, if that makes sense.
And what this is these gases could be linked to biological processes and cycles we see on Earth. So what we're searching for here and what your team is searching for is, how is this happening on Venus? Where is this coming from? When and if you get that mission there, if there were signs of life, what would we find? Would it be like microbes? Would it be something bigger? You know, what is your team looking for?
Well, we're really excited about the life opportunity or possibility. We're trying not to get overexcited and get unscientific about it. We think it has to be small or it wouldn't float. So we're not kind of imagining birds. We're thinking like microbes could float. And this does actually happen in the skies of the Earth. So here, the upper atmosphere is pretty cold. So we think maybe those microbes are just kind of tolerating it and they're like blown around by the winds and that maybe they return to the surface to do their reproduction and their life cycle and stuff. But at least means tiny things that size can float. So that's basically what we're looking for. And it's all to play for at the moment. I mean, we could find, we could easily find the gases come from some other source and it's not the tracer of life. You know, maybe we even pick the wrong two gases, even if the life is there. But so little is known about Venus because, as I said, the clouds are like too thick to look through. And the number of actual pictures from the surface is tiny. It's like less than five, I think, because the surface is so hot. You send your lander, like you try and get your data back, and then, you know, you turn around, your lander has just melted into a puddle, basically. So, you know, if we find something really unexpected is the origin of these gases, that will also be like super amazing, even if it wasn't the life sign we were looking for.
And Jane, that was going to be my next question is, it's so hot. It's the hottest planet in our solar system. So if there was life, you're saying it most likely wouldn't be able to survive on the surface, to be in the clouds.
Yeah.
Thinking like when I was a kid, I played the lava monster game. That's the only thing that could live there, at least on the surface. So you're saying that if there was life on Venus, it would live in the clouds.
Yeah, we can't really think of any sensible life process that would work. I mean, I'd love the lava monster to like wake up on the camera, but like chemical reactions that you need and like cell membranes that you need for any kind of life, we can really imagine. We can't really find any like chemistry that would work at insanely hot temperatures, like hundreds of degrees, you know, like hundreds of degrees even above water boiling kind of temperature. And like literally some of the softer metals do melt, which is the problem if you've sent your expensive electronics to the surface. So that's why we think the clouds. So it was Carl Sagan and his collaborator Harold Moravitz in the 1960s who were the first to really realize that the clouds are the pressures kind of similar to, you know, what's in your house today, and the temperatures, you know, kind of a nice summer day sort of temperature at that place where the pressure is like that. So that's what they started calling temperate conditions. And so that's what we're focused on.
And so, you know, you proposed this at the Royal Astronomical Society's National Astronomy Meeting. Again, that's a huge title.
We call it NAM for short, shorter words.
And you and your team proposed this to basically go send the spacecraft, search for these gases. How was the proposal taken by other members that were there? And what are your next steps with this? You know, I know you mentioned that you would need some partners on this. So again, just walk me through these next steps.
Yeah. So I think people were pretty interested. It's hard to tell because there was a rush of like great ideas, you know, observatory on the back of the moon, all sorts of really cool things. So, you know, sometimes you get more excited by other people's things. But yeah, what we're doing is putting together the team specifically has to be, you know, representing European nations. So we have a fabulous chemist working in Poland, Janusz Pekowski. You know, we're the heart of the instrument team is in Wales, which is, you know, the smaller country part of the United Kingdom. And then, you know, we have people who understand calculating about atmospheres in Spain. We're really trying to bring a whole team together that hasn't worked really together before, because this is such novel science. So it's fantastic to do. Like the fact we could even have like a prototype design that looks like it would work is very exciting. And we're building, in fact, on the legacy of a German team that built a small spectrometer instrument to measure gases, and it's on its way to Jupiter to measure gases there. And so because they did all that hard work, then we can just say, like, would you help us? Maybe we could build like a little version of what you did to go to Venus. And, you know, they're excited about that. So,
and that's really important, too, in itself, you know, that collaboration between other space agencies, between other nations. This would kind of be the first mission back to Venus in a long time. So that in itself, I'm sure, is makes this even just more important, right?
Yeah, I hope so. I think like a lot of new countries and regions are stepping up to do Venus science, because like you say, it's been scarcely visited in the last couple of decades. There's been an amazing Japanese mission, Akatsuki, in orbit, and that took about 10 years of data, and that's been a huge success and really inspirational. But I believe they lost contact with it after this heroically long mission about a year ago. And now lots of places you might not necessarily expect, Korea, United Arab Emirates, you know, are all thinking, you know, we're a space-going nation. We have scientists to contribute. So I find this really inspirational, actually. People can share ideas and send a whole team of different spacecraft there.
And Jane, as you go forward with making this mission possible, with trying to send this spacecraft, I mean, are you worried? Are you excited? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm super excited. I mean, I keep saying to myself, like, we just sat in our NAM, our National Astronomy Meeting, hearing these other amazing, like, totally viable ideas. And so I can't get too excited. It is only a proposal. A lot of the others you know, can do amazing science from less challenging orbits, like in low Earth orbit or lunar orbit. And so maybe we won't be the front runners. But everybody I spoke to, I was like tentatively like, we've got this idea and we know you've got the skills. Would you even consider joining us? And I think everybody said yes. So I know, you know, we've got a lovely team and a lot of enthusiasm to go forward if we can do that.
Jane Greaves is a professor at Cardiff University in Wales. Jane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come, what can humans learn from birds? That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Did you know that moon dust isn't just for science and research? It's also for art. Alan Bean, an Apollo moonwalker, was also an artist, combining his love for painting and his experience walking on the moon by putting moon dust into his art. We'll speak about Alan Bean and how moon dust played a role in his art. That's on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about book recommendations. This time, one about birds. It's summer, and once again, we are highlighting another space-related book, Space for Birds: Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. Author Roberta Bonder, the first Canadian woman astronaut and neurologist in space, believes that birds can teach us humans a lot about flying, while learning how to take better care of our planet. We spoke with Bonder late last year about her career that led her to becoming an author and her book. Here's that conversation now. Well, Roberta, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, Roberta, in 1992, you flew on Space Shuttle Discovery on STS-42 into orbit, and now you wrote a book, Photographing Birds. Please tell me, connect the dots. How did we get from space to down here on Earth tracking birds?
Well, in the book itself, I have a number of space photographs because what occurred to me in orbit was that I couldn't hear bird sounds. I know it sounds trite, but honestly, when you're up surrounded by a lot of human-made equipment and you can't see life and you certainly can't hear it. So for me, it was a bit of a harbinger of what it would be like if we lost things in the natural environment.
Did you have an interest or fascination with birds before you left the planet?
From the time I was a little girl, and I used to look at birds, and when we used to go camping in Wisconsin and Michigan from Sioux, Canada, my parents were very, very good about looking at the natural world and getting us interested in naming butterflies and birds. In biology, I excelled and decided that if there was a time when I could do something to help birds in any way, that I would like to do it. So I had a few career things that I was doing along the way, became a doctor, etc. And then when I got into space, I thought, I want to do something when I come back for the world that I couldn't see from space. And that was the natural environment upon which we depend so much.
I know there is the overview effect, right? This once you leave the planet and you see our planet against the blackness of space and you see that thin blue line, it kind of changes your perspective on things. It sounds like you had that moment with the natural world and with the wildlife down here on Earth, did you not?
I believe very deeply that we take our personal biases up into space. And so people who are very committed to a religious sense become more committed afterwards, or something else that they have valued before they left the planet. I went up there with a background steeped in science, but I also wanted to be very open to new ideas or to a new thought, so that I wanted to get above the planet. I wanted to look at the planet, but it was also important for me to look beyond the planet. And when I did, it was this light-sucking black is all I can call it, and stars that don't twinkle, just pinpricks of light. I really focused my attention on the planet below me that was reflecting sunlight basically back up to my eyes, and it set a whole new tone for me to see the edge of our planet against this infinite black universe beyond. I think it was that kind of edge moment, that to see the Earth as a planet, to be in that moment.
Were you prepared for that moment?
I was prepared in the sense that I wanted, it was like my arms were open like solar panels in terms of my frame and my head. I wanted to do more than just the science, because as the first Canadian woman in space and the world's first neurologist, I wanted to use my whole sensory system to try to bring this adventure back to people who are not going to fly in space, but to try to put some kind of realistic tone around it, to be able to communicate that. That was the important thing to me, whether it was through photography or through words. I just felt it was important to do that. And that's what I wanted to wrap my mind around. But I wasn't quite sure what the edges were going to look like when I got up there. I prepared the best I could, looking at all kinds of Earth observation photographs from other space missions before my flight. But it certainly wasn't the same sense as the reality of being there.
One thing I always find so fascinating about talking to astronauts is how they utilize a photography from orbit, from their spacecraft, and they get some training on it before they go up there, right? Had you been an amateur photographer before getting up to orbit, and how did your training prepare you to take images from space?
When I grew up in my hometown, it's not really an area where one would think you'd have a lot of contact with high-end cameras. But I was very fortunate that my dad was interested in photography. And although we couldn't afford cameras, my uncle, who was a bachelor at that time, he was the Northern Ontario rep for Leica and Nikon, and he was a pharmacist. So he'd have these cameras in his drugstore. And so he would loan these to my dad. So I learned about sharing and learned about the value of photography from a very early age. And then throughout my scientific training, through my master's and PhD program into my medical career and also as a neurologist, I was using photography to be able to talk about the specimens I was looking at.
And so that translated to what you brought to orbit when you were taking shots from orbit?
Yes, it did. And the other thing that I really became convinced of is that I needed other professional training. And we had the IMAX camera on board for getting scenes from Destiny in space. One of the things that I cherished was that I had interaction with the IMAX crew. And they said, well, Roberta, you know, if you want to do this, then perhaps you should go to Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara, California, as it was in those days, and take some more courses. So I did. So that after my space flight, I really became much more focused on looking at the planet in a way that I had wanted to, but with much more professional capability.
It's not lost upon me that you're taking your experiences in photography before your space flight up to space, but now you have taken your space flight experience and brought it to your photography. Some of these images that you have in this book, you're flying an aircraft. How has that kind of influenced the way you select photos or frame photos or decide what you're going to take images of?
As a fixed-wing pilot, I'm quite shocked that I am thrilled to be in a helicopter taking images. But the advantage of the aerial work is that it's a platform in between space and the surface. It's a platform that we can share with birds. It allows me to try to express what they might be seeing in terms of relationship between land and water. So the habitat itself, as much as the inhabitants, is extremely important to me. And so I wanted with the aerial work to make them artistic. So as a pilot, I could tell the helicopter pilot, I wanted to bank 3 degrees more, or I wanted to pitch in a certain way, or if I wanted to rotate or go back. I could do all this. And the pilots were very, very keen because we had conversations before flight about what I was trying to accomplish. Because as you said, my view of the planet was much changed by my experience in space, to see things from different angles, to not be disoriented because things were kind of upside down and sideways. And I learned the value of the horizon in my images. But this whole business of obliqueness, which is not necessarily a comfortable direction for people on the planet. They prefer horizontal and vertical. It became very important in my work and how I try to create these artistic panels.
So your background in aircraft and space flight, it definitely helps with the mechanics of taking photographs, but you also managed to capture the flight of birds, which is much different than the mechanical flight that we're used to. Tell me a bit about what you're trying to capture when it comes to the mechanics of flight in these birds.
Yes, the two birds that I feature in this book, long legs and long necks, and one of them's endangered and is white and it's in the Western Hemisphere, and the other is pink and in the Eastern Hemisphere. So I wanted to be able to show off these birds on the two hemispheres as an astronaut. So I was able to do that. And I picked large birds so I could see them from the air. So that was another quality that I wanted, to be able to try to show somehow their migration corridor. And I can't do that without a huge video that goes on forever. But I thought at least if I could take images, first of all, I wanted my pals in the astronaut program to photograph from the International Space Station various coordinates along the migratory corridors, because from space, you can't see the whole migratory corridor in one view. It's just too big from low Earth orbit. That was one piece. And then the next piece, the aerial part, to show them they're actually in the environment. It was hard sometimes, certainly for the whooping crane. I did not want to get close to them. It's something I just don't want to do. So I was up 1,000 feet. I would not get lower than that. And then when I followed the whooping crane across the United States, for example, down from Canada, I wanted to fly over the areas of their very narrow but well-known flight migratory corridor, 4,200 kilometers each way. Twice a year they do this. So I wanted to be able to show that they are very strong, that they had the idea that they had a home to go to, that they relied on the natural world of Earth to be able to maintain this long migration that they make. And with the lesser flamingos, it was more of an opportunity to actually be above them when they were flying, because they have groupthink so different than the whooping crane, and they all fly off together. So you can see that from the air, but certainly the whooping cranes are much more solitary. The differences in the flight, that's what I wanted to show as well, that the strength and the power and the emotional connection that these birds have to this corridor and the faithfulness to it was very important to me.
Your focus on these birds goes beyond just the book, right? Can you tell me a bit about your work with the Avian Migration Aerial Surface Space Project?
Yes, when I started as an astronaut, you always want acronyms. When I was becoming a principal investigator with NASA on bird migration a number of years ago, to be able to continue to access space files, I decided on this term called a MASS. It stands for Avian Migration Aerial Surface and Space, the three perspectives that I use in the book. We've also called it Space for Birds because non astronaut fights, like non-space travelers might have a problem with this acronym. But NASA loved it. We refer to that as the AMAS project. In fact, NASA did a nice video about the project put on their Earth Observation website, and they really enjoyed AMAS. So that's where that came from. So we are continuing to look at endangered and near threatened species in the world. And I'm currently now into, I call it book two only because I don't have a working title for it yet, but it will feature a few other birds, much smaller and none that I can really photograph from the air. They're too small, but I can certainly photograph their habitat and create artistic images of that. But they are the, you know, things like the piping birds, like the piping plover or the red knot or Brake's pipit, the Arctic tern. These are birds that are in North America or in the Western Hemisphere. They go down to the southern hemisphere sometimes for overwintering. So we're following them, and they're delightful birds. And just trying to raise people's awareness of other kinds of birds is very important to me.
Roberta, I want to end our conversation by going back to the beginning. You know, a theme of this book is the fragility within ourselves and within the birds. In fact, you write, we see our fragility in theirs, and we are moved to learn more to help us to help them. What is the takeaway that you want readers to gain from this book that really does combine the beauty of nature and the scientific importance of protecting our planet?
If we ignore the natural world, we do it at our own peril. We need the natural world to do so many things. I mean, there's a view of looking at it as a service industry. I'd like to look at it a bit more emotionally, because there are living organisms that are fragile. You set aside plants and trees, which you just don't want to get rid of either. But when we look at things like birds, they actually can pull us across the planet. And when we study them, we actually see areas and are become much more sensitive to areas that require research, or that we can learn things and adapt them to our technology. We can learn about the dynamics of flight still. We can learn about the efficiencies. I mean, we don't understand this groupthink that Nestor flamingos have, for example, or that people see when they see all these blackbirds flying in unison, and then suddenly in one split second, they move as one. So all the technology that is out there for us as humans to learn from and to incorporate into our own world to try to make it a better place, a more inspirational place, a place that does have hope, and a place from which we can have terrestrial applications of being aware of the natural world. It was indelible for me from my space flight.
Roberta, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Roberta Bonder, the first Canadian woman astronaut and neurologist in space, and the author of Space for Birds, Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. We have more summer space book recommendations on our website. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, really, wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you'd like to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Ashley Reap. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.